WPWK, brought to you by Klipsch Audio.
Well, I have another legend in the studio with me right now, and that is Mr. Eddie Kramer. Good morning.
Good morning.
We have a lot to talk about in the next couple hours, but I wanted to talk about the early days first a little bit. For those of you who may not be aware of Eddie's history pre-Hendrix, you started as a classical pianist.
Yeah, I studied classical piano in South Africa, actually, where I was born and raised, and I played piano from about the age of four till I left high school, 18, 19 years old. But in the middle, I got sort of waylaid by rock and roll and jazz, much to my father's chagrin. He was very disappointed that I didn't turn out to be a classical pianist.
Do you still play?
Yeah, I try. I mean, I tinkle the ivories, if that's what you mean.
That's what I mean. Like, you play for yourself.
Yeah. I mean, you know, if I'm in the studio, I always wander over to the piano and just try to limber up my fingers.
Well, I saw you do that last night at the Varvedo store, but that piano is grossly out of tune.
I'm afraid that piano is a non-piano.
Yeah, I think so. In any case, when you moved to the UK, after you moved to the UK, you started as an assistant engineer at the legendary Pi Studios. They were doing a lot of recording with a lot of great artists. Do you want to mention some of the artists you work with?
It was a fantastic studio because it gave me a tremendous grounding in basic engineering techniques. The guy who was my boss, Bob Orger, was probably the best engineer in England because he was able to do classical music, pop, rock, at the beginnings of rock, of course. But I used to go on the road with him to a big concert hall called Walthamstow Town Hall, and we would record a 90-piece symphony orchestra with just three microphones.
Oh my gosh.
And that's how I learned how to record classical music, and I applied that technique later on to how to record drums for Zeppelin and people like that.
But I was going to ask you if you were able to use those techniques in your...
But we would, you know, one day we'd be recording a 90-piece symphony orchestra. The next day, we'd be back at Pi recording Petula Clark or The Kinks.
Or The Kinks, right.
So there was a ton of stuff that we were doing. There's a lovely gentleman by the name of Sammy Davis Jr.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes, we did a tremendous amount of work with him. And Pi was an interesting place because it was the home for a lot of American labels. The early Warner Brothers stuff, or actually Reprise, was sent over. And Chess, we also represented Chess. So I got to fool around with the discs of all of the imports that were coming in. Fantastic blues stuff, you know, mm-hmm. Chuck Berry and Bo Diddley and people like that. And we would play. I was a disc jockey, actually, for Radio Luxembourg.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Well, I was the DJ, the engineer who actually spun the records. We had a DJ who was actually speaking, but we, as the two young kids, you know, what did we know? We just loved this music, and we kept seeing all the stuff coming. Hey, man, can we play this radio? Yeah, okay, sure.
And that was a pirate radio station.
It wasn't pirate. It was a pre-recorded show for Radio Luxembourg, which was a huge AM station.
And people used to get that on shortwave radio or...
Shortwave and then medium, longwave, whatever they had. Mm-hmm. And when you think about it, in early 62, 63, I'm sure we were influencing a lot of musicians who were hearing all this R&B.
Also radio DJs, I'm sure. I know John Peel was influenced as well. And so, of course, they had Radio Caroline after that.
Which was on a boat.
And then, of course, they BBC launched Radio 1 and took all of those DJs, pop DJs, over there. Well, that's really exciting. Then you started KPS Studios, which was your own recording studio.
It was a little demo studio. It was in existence for about a year, and then we were taken over by a gentleman called Lord Baring, who basically he owned Regent Sound, which is where the Stones had done their actual first album. So he took us over, and then, well, more things happened. From there, I went to Olympic.
Now, Olympic is really where you kind of were able to work with a lot of great artists, and some of whom you started working with for the for their entire careers, which we'll get to.
Yeah, there were a few.
But you also work with Jimmy Miller, who is a producer, and you work with him on Traffic.
Traffic, one of my favorite bands. They were incredibly eclectic driven by blues and folk music. And of course, they had this incredible singer named Steve Winwood.
Who was really a prodigy,
actually. Oh, he was 17. I think he was 16 or 17 when I first started working with him. The band was put together, and the guy who owned Island Records was
Chris Blackwell.
Chris Blackwell, yeah, from the Cross and Blackwell family. Mm-hmm. You know, because he was started in Jamaica, and when he came to England, he was selling Jamaican records out of the trunk of his car. That's how his company started. But he knew he wanted a rock band, and he put this band together. But he wanted an American producer, and he knew about Jimmy Miller. Jimmy was an entertainer, actually. He was from Vegas.
Really?
Yeah, he was a comedian and a drummer.
Wow.
And he brought, so he comes over to London, and he's this big, tall guy, very friendly, very cool guy. And we immediately clicked. So we worked on the Traffic album, and that became obviously a big success.
Klipsch Audio, pissing off the neighbors since 1946.
Jimmy Miller was such a fantastic producer. I was saying earlier, I wanted to model myself after him if I ever did decide to become a producer, which I did eventually.
And he was my model. You certainly did.
On that song, if you listen to how it's sort of just floating along very nicely, and then all of a sudden, the band jumps into a double tempo, and you hear this whole bunch of maracas going, and then they... And what has actually happened was, we're in the middle of recording, everything's going great, and I'm in the mood here, and everything's cool, and the lights are down, and there's a pall of smoke hanging in the control room. And I turn around, and Jimmy Miller has completely disappeared. Where the hell did he go? I just see his butt running across the floor of the studio, because we set up Traffic at the very far end of Olympic on a stage, and they were playing this song live. And the next thing I see is he's jumped up on the stage, grabbed a pair of maracas, and the band's all got their heads down. All of a sudden, they look up. It's Jimmy. And he's going... And he's just shaking the hell out of the maracas, and he's indicating double time. And all of a sudden, they break into the double time, and that's what you hear. It's a live moment.
That's amazing. That's, you know, so many recordings were done live with the band all performing all at once. You only had four tracks.
That's it. Might as well get it now.
Get it now. But also, these are like the early days of really playing around with stereo.
Yes, and I definitely played around with stereo.
I could hear it.
I mean, there's phasing, and then the panning of the guitar. I love the panning. I saw the Eddie Panpots Kramer, they used to call me. Stereophonic panning, man.
Well, because of your work, your and Jimmy's work with Traffic, another band decided to enlist your talent and Jimmy's talent, and that was the Rolling Stones.
Yeah, I think the Stones heard the Traffic record, and they had met with Jimmy, and he was such a cool guy. They said, all right, we got to get back to our roots, and Jimmy would be the guy. And they hired him, much to the chagrin of other folks, namely their producer manager,
Andrew Luke Oldham.
Who was suddenly out of the picture.
Yeah.
And I think Jimmy Miller produced the best Rolling Stones albums, bar none. I mean, the guy just had it in his hand. He knew how to take those Rolling Stone characters and mold them into this one unit. And if they weren't doing the thing the way he was hearing it, he would go in the studio and show them how to play it. Like, for instance, some of the drum parts, he would go in and play, because he was a good drummer.
Right.
You know, not that Charlie was a brilliant drummer, but sometimes, you know, because he's basically a jazz blues drummer, Jimmy was hearing a different sort of a beat, and so Jimmy would go and show him how he wanted it.
Well, he was working with them you both were working with them at a very transitional time, because in some ways they kind of got caught up in the fashion of the moment with the psychedelic movement. So when the Beatles put out Sgt. Pepper, they responded pretty quickly with their Satanic Majesty's Request, which does have some great songs on it, but it's not the definitive Rolling Stones record. I mean, from beginning to end, it's not a classic.
Yeah, sorry to interrupt. But I also feel that at that same time they were being hounded by this detective, I guess, from the Metropolitan Police, who was bound and determined to bust them
For drugs.
For drugs,
right?
And, of course, he eventually did, you know, and we all know what happened with that. They got off.
Right.
But, you know, I think that that Satanic Majesty's record was maybe not their best work. Interesting record.
Yeah, it has a few good songs that I really like, but it wasn't pure Stones. And it was you and Jimmy reeling them kind of back in and getting Beggar's Banquet
was happening. Mm-hmm. And I think from that point, they just really got better.
And there was a single that you recorded during those same sessions.
Jumping Jack Flash.
That's right.
Which was very cool because we'd used Jimmy Miller's Wallensack, which is a cassette machine, plopped it in the middle of all the band and recorded the basic track, played it back on a small little Philips speaker, put a microphone in front, and that became the basic track for Jumping Jack Flash and a few others, actually. Parachute Woman and Street Fighting Man, all were done that way.
Klipsch Audio, pissing off the neighbors since 1946.
I love that, what you just said about pissing off the neighbors. We've got to keep doing that.
We do. Now, also, along with the Rolling Stones, another gentleman showed up in the Olympic Studios. He was being managed by the former bass player of the Animals, Chaz Chandler. And this gentleman was an American, but he found his success first over in the UK, like many Americans do. Who are we talking about?
James Marshall Hendricks, the geezer with the big hair.
Exactly. So what was your first encounter with Jimmy when he came into Olympic?
I'd known about Jimmy as all of us engineers at Olympic had sort of seen all the magazines he'd come out with. Hey Joe, there's a story about Jimmy, you know, everybody knows this. He was discovered playing in a club, the Café Noir in New York, in the Village, and Chas Chandler saw him there, and he was actually playing Hey Joe, and that sealed the deal for Chas. He said, you're coming with me. And so I think round about August of 66, Chas brings him over to London, and within a month he's playing the Paris Olympia, put the band together. I mean, literally 30 days putting a band together and you're playing the Paris Olympia,
and he's
on the bill with Johnny Hallyday.
And he's making people like Eric Clapton and Pete Townsend second guessing themselves.
Oh yeah. No, they all cried. They just wanted to go home babies. They were no. It's an interesting little side story that Johnny Hallyday, who was a great French rock and roller, because Jimmy was opening the bill, Jimmy would stand at the back and watch Johnny Halliday's movement. Jimmy was a student of rock, unbeknownst to many. He would study everybody, check out what their moves were like, and incorporate them into his own act. Because after all, he was a showman as well as a fantastic guitar player and a genius. But he was
put
a performer.
On a show, yeah.
They recorded Hey Joe and I think When Cries Mary at one studio, but then they became very unhappy with the sound in the room, and also the fact it was in the basement of there was a bank above it and they couldn't make noise and all this kind of stuff. So they heard about Olympic had just been completed, and starting in January of 67, Chas Chandler and Jimi Hendrix arrive at Olympic. And I remember him coming into the studio and just sitting in the corner very quietly smoking a cigarette and huddled up in this very shabby white raincoat, a bit grubby, and not saying much at all until the gear was set up. And I remember his roadie was this big guy with a big beard, and he was quite intimidating in those days. And he comes staring up the stairs of Olympic with a big Marshall stack on his back and a couple of amps. He says, "Oi, where do you want this lot then?" I think over there, mate. And they set up all the amps, and Jimmy plugs in, and it was just, all of a sudden, there was this, the room just sort of lit up, not only with his sound, but also the fact that there was something electric in the air. I mean, it was just incredible. Just the fact when he hit that guitar and you heard that first chord, it was like, it just took your breath away. Mm. And how do I hang? Am I going to record this guy? It's going to be really tricky. But I soon figured it out. And he would come in the control room and have a listen And he would be smiling, oh yeah, okay, let me just go out there for a second. So he would run out and stop fiddling with the amp and the pedals and do some kind of adjustment to his sound. And I'd be scrambling like mad and putting reverb and compression and EQ and doing all the kinds of tricks that I could think of. And he would come back in and have another listen. And, oh, yeah. And so everything we did was, all right, you do that, well, I'm going to do this. And if you do that, I'm going to... And we upped the ante so much that we were trying to top each other. And it was a wonderful, funny competition. But the result was the sound got better. And we were always experimenting. And I think we just, I don't know why, we just clicked like that. It was just magic, I guess.
That's amazing. Because you work with him for his entire career and even posthumously with the
estate. Yeah, we continue to do the work on Jimmy, and we love doing it. We really do.
You're listening to WPWK, Loud and Proud.
In the studio with me is someone who is very experienced, and that is Mr. Eddie Kramer.
Let's not talk about my private life, please.
No.
So I want to tell you a little quick story that I can remember so clearly. The way that Mitch played was hysterical, because Mitch was like this little elfin geezer. He was a little tiny guy, but had the most amazing sense of time. And his fills, his drum fill, I mean, this is a very difficult song. It's so hard for anybody to even play. It's 6/8, and his fills are all over the place. And many of the takes broke down with laughter, because he would do a drum fill that you think, there's no way, he's never going to land on one. And he does, and Jimmy would just turn his head around and be laughing. He'd be laughing. He would just crack up laughing, because Mitch would be doing this ridiculous fill. And that's what the sessions were like. They were a lot of fun. You know, Jimmy was funny as hell. I don't know if anybody really understands how funny Jimmy was. He had this incredibly sharp, acerbic sense of humor, and he would take that piss out of me and Mitch and Noel, and then himself, a lot of self-deprecating humor.
It's very just British, actually, that kind of humor.
It was, but it was very understated, but you have to say it was just right on the money. He would just know exactly where to stick the needle in, you know. And I think it was done for many reasons, you know, to relieve the tension of the, you know, if things got a little bit out of hand, you know, he would try to... In fact, what also happened, he would suddenly play the theme from Batman or something like that, just just to make everybody laugh. All right, come on, let's get back to work, kind of thing. So, yeah, good old Mitch.
Now, for the second album, did Jimmy envision... I mean, these albums were done so close together, first of all. I mean, albums, contracts were like two albums a year, weren't they?
And incidentally, I have this photograph of him that I took at Olympic where he's actually playing an acetate of Are You Experienced, but we're working already on Axis.
My gosh.
And there was no stopping. I mean, it just was continuous work. And he loved being... I mean, the studio was second home to him.
Mm-hmm. Now, did he want to take something in a different direction with the next album, or was just kind of continuing as usual?
Yes, I think there was a very conscious effort, not only on his part, but Chaz's as well, to expand Jimmy's horizon. Certainly I wanted to sonically, which I started to do a stereophonic drum recording, which we hadn't had before. It was mostly with mono. Now I'm recording the drums in stereo, trying to use more of the four track machine than I even had before, going 4 to 4 to 4, trying to make everything as stereophonic as I could, and experimenting more. And I also think Jimmy's songwriting really started to blossom.
Especially with the song Little Wing, which is just a beautiful, beautiful song.
Yeah,
we're going to play a different song, aren't we? Bold as Love.
Yeah, Axis Bold as Love was an interesting track. We were experimenting, actually, with phasing. And there's sort of a little backstory that involved the Beatles in this. We were very fortunate to work with the Beatles. And we asked George Martin at the time, could you tell us how you got that phasing sound for the Beatles? And he said, well, chaps, you know, and he was a very tall, very spiffy Englishman, you know, raised himself up to his 6'3" height or whatever. Said, you know, chaps, if you open up the BBC Radiophonics Handbook from 1949, you'll actually find it in there. Ah, thanks, George. Big help you are. So we decided to experiment, and the Beatles had done it in mono, and we just said, okay, we're going to beat that. We're going to be the first people to have it in stereo. And for a couple of weeks, it was a lot of experimentation, and finally figured out how to do it. And we said, Jimmy, would you come in for a second? We want to play you something. And it was this track. And where the drums kick in the middle when it goes into phasing, Jimmy was sitting on the couch, and he heard this for the first time, and he totally freaked out, lost his mind, grabbed his head in his hand and sort of dropped to the floor and said, ah, oh my God, what's that? And we said, it's phasing. Oh, play it again. So we played it again. He said, oh man, I want that shit on everything.
You're listening to WPWK, Keepers of the Sound.
We were given full onboard permission. Go, Squire. It was Chaz who said a wonderful thing to us, and right in the beginning he said, the rules are, there are no rules. And it just sort of opened the floodgates for us, and just, well, we could just do whatever we want, as long as it sounded good, mm-hmm. You know. And even if it didn't, so what? It was part of an experiment, you know.
Well, I feel personally that Electric Ladyland, Jimmy's third album, took it even further.
Oh, yes.
And you started doing the recordings over at Olympic. But around that time, you moved to New York and started working at the record plant. So you transferred from a 4-track studio to a 12-track studio. So that must have been quite interesting and given you a lot more options.
Well, coming from London, where it was 4-track, as you said, to New York, where all bets were off. You know, this was a huge console, 12-track, 1-inch. And Jimmy and I were looking and said, yeah, man. Jimmy was so excited. He had 8 more tracks to play with. Whoopee! So the fun started there. And then we later transferred those 12 to 16. So there's a track that I think we're going to possibly play.
Mm-hmm.
I started in England in December of 67. And then we brought the 4-track to America for 68. We're in the beginning of recording Electric Ladyland. And this is a track that eventually became a top 10 single. It was Jimmy's one big shot at a single, and it was called All Along the Watchtower. Now, unbeknownst to many, during the recording of this particular track, there was a lot of arguments, not only from Chaz, but from Jimmy, and Jimmy was getting really pissed off because the gentleman who was helping him was a well-known guitar player from Traffic. And Dave Mason was supposed to be playing the secondary acoustic guitar. Jimmy was playing a 6, and Mason was playing a 12. So it was supposed to be chang, 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 chang. And then Mason was supposed to play shrang, shrang, shrang. And there was a little bit of a miscommunication, or maybe there were some adult beverages that were interfering or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think he quite got it together. And Jimmy was yelling at him. Finally, they got it together. Also, the beginning of it, the drum sequence is reversed because the time flips on a bar. And it's so hard to even think about how to correct that and play that. Anyway, we're recording the song. We get up to about take 19. And all of a sudden, you hear this bloody horrible, out of tune, out of time piano. And it's Brian Jones who had stumbled into the studio, and he was drunk on his bum. Mm-hmm. And he's trying to play. And Jimmy, of course, lovely. He loved Brian. And Jimmy was very kind to his friends, and he would never want to throw him out. But he looked at me and said, well, can you possibly get him out of here, you know what I mean? Mm. So I had to go and, Brian, come with me. It's all right. And mate, come in the control room. So he came in the control room, and he fell down in front of the console. And fell asleep.
Oh, no. know. It's almost tragic.
It was,
too,
but kind of funny, sad. Anyway, we ended up cutting the track by take 27 and wore along the bloody watchtower, mate.
WPWK, brought to you by Klipsch Audio.